Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The past is always tense, the future perfect. That is according to English novelist Zadie Smith. If you don't know which is which, however, now, that is the difference between the past tense and the future perfect, then you're in for some trouble. That is if you care. Joining us now to talk about not only grammar, but how we confront the grammatical atrocities of our age is Bill Walsh. He's a copy editor at The Washington Post and the author of three books of language commentary, Lapsing into a Comma, The Elephants of Style, and his newest, Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
And question for our listeners, what is your pet peeve? Give us a call and in a nice way, share your peeve. Our guest, Bill Walsh, will respond. The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you kick off the chapter one, with the issue of the phrase could versus couldn't care less. It's a subtitle of your book. But the subtitle of your book of that chapter is Are People Just Careless? What is the big stinking deal about the care less issue?
Well, for a long time, a lot of people have said I could care less when they really mean I couldn't care less. After all, if you could care less, that means you care a certain amount. And so I have kind of a good-natured, ongoing argument with the people who study language more dispassionately than I do. And they know a lot more than you or I or most sticklers, and they consider us a bit elitist when we take things a little bit too literally and we label certain usages as incorrect or annoying. And so I study what they say and what sticklers like me say and try to come to a consensus in the middle there. But the bottom line is that language change is inevitable and the smart money is always on the inevitable, but that doesn't mean we have to be happy about it.
You call yourself a stickler, but I remember from the last time you were on, you're pretty forgiving about a lot of peccadilloes out there, you know, the way people talk.
I am kind of a strange mix. My feelings are complicated. I tend to poo-poo a lot of the English teacher rules that people may have been swatted with a ruler about. Never split an infinitive, or never end a sentence with a preposition, or never begin a sentence with and or but. And so you find a lot of those, what people call zombie rules, rules that either stopped being relevant a long time ago or really never were rules in the first place. Split infinitives is something, the rule against that is borrowed from Latin, because in Latin, infinitives are one word and you couldn't possibly split them. So some people take that English, it's improper to split infinitives, and that's just wrong to call that wrong.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Something I learned relatively late in my writing career was the hyphenating multiple adjectives before a noun. I was lucky enough to work with someone who understood that very well and taught me finally what it meant, and now I'm totally into it. Can you tell our listeners what I'm talking about? Because I can only tell you that I'm into it.
That's one area where I become a bit of an extremist. I like my hyphens. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you have a modifier of more than one word, you're supposed to signify that to a reader by linking them together with hyphens. So you would say, I eat ice cream on a cone, no hyphen, but an ice cream cone, you get a hyphen between ice and cream to signify that ice and cream form a single modifier there. Now, ice cream cone is one that a lot of editors, vast majority of editors, would not hyphenate because they argue that it's so common, so recognizable, you don't need to provide that extra cue to the reader. I take the opposite viewpoint and say it doesn't hurt anything to provide that cue. That way, if you get to the end of a line or the end of a page and you see ice, the next word isn't, you might expect the next word to be cream, so plain old noun, ice cream, but actually ice cream as an adjective, they're modifying cone. And so that provides it just prevents you from being misled and led down the wrong road for just a millisecond.
The one that really came through for me was high school teacher.
And that, again, is another one where even some pretty strict hyphenators will leave that one out.
And I won't, because high school teacher?
Right. There are school teachers who are high, so you want to make that absolutely clear, and so stick in that hyphen. Or it comes up more often with sort of ad hoc formulations.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama had a couple of people to the White House, and they called it the beer summit, or say you call it the beer mug summit.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't just want beer, dramatic pause, mug summit. You want beer mug together to hang together, and so you stick a hyphen in there. Peanut butter and jelly sandwich, that requires a number of hyphens, and again, you look like an extremist there, but there's a certain, I guess it's the does anal retentive have a hyphen joke, where that's the anal retentive editor in me who just wants that to be very, very tidy. But I do acknowledge that, that's perhaps a little extremist.
Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air with Bill Walsh, author of Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Good program. Pet peeve is the people who always say, not a problem, when you say thank you. And my immediate response is to want to say, I know it's not a problem, I just paid you.
There, I would disagree with you there. I have kind of a contrarian point on some of those things. Thank you doesn't necessarily have to have the you're welcome. We have these kind of cultural rituals where you say thank you, I say you're welcome, and that's the way it has to be. I consider it a healthy evolution that people got tired of saying you're welcome and came up with other things to say. And so you see this also with, would you like a Pepsi? No, I'm fine. Well, I didn't ask you whether you were fine or not. I asked you whether you wanted a lovely beverage. And so some of these rote responses, I think we sticklers cling to a little bit too much. And that's, as Anne said, I can be a little loosey-goosey there, and I guess this is one of those areas.
All right, Alan, thanks a lot for that call. If anyone out there has a question or comment for my guest, Bill Walsh, the number to call is 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You're kind of mellow in many ways, but I was surprised to read that you didn't grow up being taught to diagram a sentence. I don't know why, but I learned it in junior high, and I loved doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know really why, Bill. I just did.
I imagine if I had had a better primary education, I would be in that camp too. It just isn't something that ever crossed my path. And in retrospect, I kind of think it's a healthy development for me. You see people use the diagram sort of, they know 75% of it, and so they'll pull out their diagramming to prove something that I'm wrong about something when I know I'm right. The one that I always seize on is, she's one of the only people who still watches Grey's Anatomy. Well, no, she's one of the only people who still watch Grey's Anatomy. Just because one is the subject of the sentence doesn't mean every verb later in that sentence gets a singular, has to be singular.
Mm-hmm.
Of those people who still watch Grey's Anatomy, she is one. We're not just talking about her, we're talking about all those people. So that's my beef with sentence diagramming isn't so much it in particular, it's people who don't quite get it right tend to use it as a cudgel.
Mm-hmm. Tom and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. I have a comment. I think the most misused word in the English language, and I won't make you guess, my opinion is the word free, F-R-E-E. And I'll give you an example. An ad that comes on and says, buy one suit and you get two more suits free. And it may be a turn on for some people to hear that or read it every time they see it free. But for me, it's a turn off. I'd like your guest's opinion.
So is your... Are you saying that it's not really free? It's just that if you buy one and get two free, that's a 66.6% discount?
Yes.
Right.
They don't. It's not free. They just load it on somewhere else.
Right. Ad speak is a big source of pet peeves, and the other one that is similar is 0% interest. Well. Yeah, that's a cute way of saying interest-free, but it's, you know, yes, it's 0%, but why do you have to call it that? I mean, they call it that because it's cute. I thought you were going somewhere else with free because there's another issue there, which is that people say for free, right?
Mm-hmm.
Free isn't a noun, it's an adjective, and so you're getting it free of charge. It's a free lunch. But for you're getting it for nothing, not for free. Now, there are cases where it's just impossible to use it without for, but I try to write around those. Technically, you're supposed to say something, you get something free, not something for free.
All right, Tom and Marion, thanks a lot for that call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More of this conversation about language and grammar with author Bill Walsh. Still to come, but first, membership director Rob Walker and All Sides producer Michael DeBonis are here to tell you why you should support 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Bill Walsh. He's a copy editor at The Washington Post and author of three books on language commentary. His latest is... Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk. If you have a question or comment for Bill Walsh, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Jeff in German Village. He writes, speaking of hyphens, never hyphenate an L-Y word, correct?
The general guideline is that an adverb ending in ly need not take a hyphen because it's so painfully obvious that nothing else could be happening there, an easily remembered rule. You don't need to link that together, and that is correct. Where people go wrong is they take that to mean a family-run business can't be hyphenated because family ends in ly, but of course... It's just a coincidence that family ends in ly. It's not an adverb meaning in a family manner. And so you have to watch out there. And there are words that look that are a little more tricky than that, that adjectives that end in ly that
maybe
look like
we,
adverbs.
So when they're asking that question about ly, curly-haired baby,
right. So curly there, again, it's a coincidence, mm-hmm. but it's a little more tricky. It's not quite like family. But curly, the suffix is the Y, not the L-Y. So you would hyphenate curly-haired baby.
Okay. Jack in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Jack.
Hi there. I had a question. It seems to me that the word impact used to be exclusively a noun, like you made an impact. Not something impacted something, you know, with the exception of maybe, you know, dental work. But it seems like now, you know, it's everywhere as just being actively used as a noun, as a verb, and also impactful.
Right.
Quite a bit.
And that came up in some of the talk during the pledge break. Yeah, if you're a stickler, and in general, the state of the art now is that impact as a verb, unless you mean impacted teeth, is frowned upon. it's tricky there. It's sort of in the process of evolving, and it's very common. And you can make the argument that because it's so common, it's fine. Where the objection to this is more like the other gentleman's objection to free, where it's ad speak, it's business speak, it's jargon.
Right.
And so you sort of sound like an advertising person or somebody writing public relations copy when you say impacting the economy. And so effect is generally what sticklers want to see there.
Effect with an A.
Effect with an A, indeed.
Great. All right, Jack, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. And let's see, Mark in Columbus. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Mark here?
Yep.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I've been curious for a long time about the spoken use of the initials IE, which is, to my understanding, is Latin for id est, and it just, I don't know, pompous isn't the right word, but I just wondered if that was considered proper. I know, like, EG's, is only two syllables as opposed to the longer Latin, but IE just doesn't make that sense.
That's not something I've ever thought of, but... I think wouldn't it be more pompous to say id est? People are used to reading IE in that sense, and so I think if you're looking to reduce pomposity, that's probably your better choice is to go
for the English that is, which is the
or same. Well, yes, to truly be non-pompous, just stick with English. That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, but it's not considered a taboo or anything then.
No, I think if you're going to use IE, that's how you would pronounce it.
Okay.
All right.
Been curious.
Thanks, Chris. I guess, though, I wonder if, or Mark, I'm sorry, if something like that gets more popular or is more popular because of the way we're writing shorter in emails and texts and that sort of thing, Bill.
I would maybe say that with LOL, probably not with IE. There's a bit of a, I'm not sure you see. Well, maybe you do see IE on Twitter. I guess that helps a little bit, but it requires those periods, and you know how people hate punctuation.
Yeah, that's true. We have an email from Sarah in Clintonville. She writes, "It drives me crazy when newscasters say police are investigating an arson fire. An arson is a fire." ! Ugh.
Can't disagree there.
Nope.
That's a mild redundancy, sure.
But is... Okay, you're right. Arson is a fire, but isn't arson? Well, I guess it doesn't really matter. It's a purposely set fire, isn't that
right? And
yeah.
So
versus an accidental fire or a fire that
police are investigating a fire, they believe arson
is involved. Yeah,
and so if the TV person's concern is that the word fire isn't there, maybe that would be a less redundant way of saying it.
Hmm. Let's see, we're turning now to Sue in Columbus. Hi, Sue, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My mother taught me many years ago that exact same and the other one went missing were absolutely incorrect, and certainly we hear it all the time today. What's the explanation for that?
Well, exact same is, again, a mild redundancy. It doesn't bother me so much because it's an intensifier. People are just trying to really hammer home that, no, really, it is the same. It's not just a little bit. And, of course, that's, like, very unique. If it's the same, it's the same. That's true. But that's
we
almost,
could say, couldn't we say properly exactly the
exactly
same?
The same. Sure. Although I'm not so sure that would be any different when you boil it right down. Exact same, though, sounds a little more playground childish. And so maybe sometimes that's your intent, that you want to be a little bit playful in your language, and so you would say something like exact same. Now, your other point, which was, again...
Went missing.
That's an interesting case where it's sort of a... It was once more common in British English, and it's one of those that have migrated across the pond. And now, I don't think this is the recency illusion, which I spoke about last time I was on the program, where something becomes an earworm for you, and you're like, nobody ever used to say that, but now it's everywhere. I think it is accurate that this is on the rise in American English, on TV news and on cable when they do the missing... Oh, my gosh, the missing pretty girl program. She went missing. It's not somebody. It used to be somebody vanished or somebody disappeared, which if if you really think about it, are kind of illogical in their own way. But those were the established American ways of saying that. And now go missing, went missing, have come over from England, and that's become almost the standard way of saying it. And I have to admit, it bothers me, too. I tend to change those to vanished and disappeared.
All right, Sue, thanks for your call. Carol and Powell, you're on the air with Bill Walsh. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Yes, I wanted to know your opinion about the use of the word anyways and also the word alls. So S's are added to anyways.
Those S's alls are very strange, aren't they? There are some words like toward or towards, they work either way. So journalists who want to save a letter will and sound a little bit more American English as opposed to British English will write and say toward instead of towards. But alls I'm saying is...
Oh, okay. I was trying to figure out what.
Yeah, okay. That one, I guess, gets an apostrophe S. So alls well has sort of migrated into alls I'm saying, which is, I think, has to be considered wrong. And anyways, again, it might be in dictionaries because it's so common. And I think its usage goes back farther than... alls I'm saying, but yes, that would be considered not standard English.
All right, Carol, thank you for your call. We have an email from Brad in Columbus. He says, I heard an ad on radio for the Ad Council, government-sponsored evidently, where the spot urged everyone to, quote, be one the people, I think he meant to say be one of the people who are making a difference, end quote. In my opinion, that's wrong, although the singular verb sounds weird. Even if people don't like the way it sounds, the singular one determines the use of the verb. Is there an additional explanation?
That's what I was getting at earlier mm-hmm. when I was ranting against the diagramming of sentences. Somebody is fixating on that one and not really thinking about the bigger picture.
You're a pretty mellow ranter, though, Bill.
Well, yeah, but you're one of the... So you're saying people who makes a difference? No, they are people who make a difference, mm-hmm. and you are one of those people. So that the Ad Council in that case is absolutely right. They probably misuse impact too, but well.
Well, we find a lot of that in ads in general. I mean, there's been a lot of books written about bad ads.
Well, you know,
or badly written ads, maybe.
Badly
is the
written
better way.
Ads, yeah. And we can go back to the 60s when Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in advertising, I sympathize. You're trying to sound different, and so you reach sort of to use a cliche to let you look outside the box, and you reach for a different way of saying the same thing, so that you don't kind of just get lost in a sea of everybody talking the same.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. More of my conversation about language with Bill Walsh is still to come. But first, here's Rob Walker and Michael DeBonis to tell you about our thank you gift this hour and to talk to you about why you should support 89.7 NPR News right now. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Bill Walsh. He's a copy editor at The Washington Post, author of three books on language commentary, the latest of which is called Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Let's go to Gwen in South Vienna. Hi, Gwen. You're on the air with Bill Walsh. Welcome.
Thank you. I was raised by a grammar snob, and 50 years later, those tapes play in my head all the time. And I did love diagramming sentences, and I still do it in my head sometimes to prove I'm right, which is exactly what you said. My question is the word unique. I was taught that means one of a kind, and today, of course, they use it just to mean unusual. Wonder what you think.
Right. So unique means one of a kind, and the objection there usually becomes where people try to modify it. Something is more unique or less unique or very unique. And, of course, you can't be more or less one of a kind. You can't be very one of a kind because once you're one of a kind, you're just one of a kind. And so I wrote a blog entry recently arguing, though, that there are certain words you can affix that are truly unique. So something could be truly unique, or it could be people call it unique, but it really isn't. And so there are sort of those in-between words where you can modify it. But in general, you're right. Unique is unique.
I agree, Gwen.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. 614-292-8513 if you want to give a call. Bill Walsh, you break the world of sticklers into two camps, the prescriptivists and the descriptivists. What's the difference?
So the people who study language, the linguists, and other observers who just say, okay, this is what people say, and that's the way it is, and I'm not going to voice an opinion one way or the other. They are describing, and so they are descriptivist. People who try to say, no, 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 that's wrong and this is right, are prescribing, and so they are prescriptivist. And so as an editor, I am kind of, my job is inherently prescriptivist. And as a bit of a stickler and an enthusiast, I'm a little bit not so dispassionate. And so I try to be a reasoned prescriptivist. So I take the evidence of what is into account, and the reality of generally what is going to stick around, and so language changes. And mm-hmm. I acknowledge all that, but I also try to point out, okay, but this might not be the same in 5 years, but right now, if you use unique the way Glenn talked about, you're going to be looked at as wrong. Whether that's right or wrong, that's just the current reality.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Steve.
Yes, my gripe is how people pronounce Pontius Pilate. The T is not silent. It should be Pontius Pilate. It's not like poncho.
So it's not like partial. You know, often a T-I forms an S-H. But that's not right there?
Steve?
There's no C-H sound in Pontius in the Latin.
In the Latin. Okay, well, that's okay. A new one for me. All but right. But in English, often a T-I can be pronounced as, or is, you would say partial, not partial. And so that's probably what people are looking at. And you know, I can never tell whether it's Anastasia or Anastasia, whether, you know, so... trying to wrap your lips around words from other languages can be kind of tricky.
Thank you, Steve. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. We have a few more minutes left with Bill Walsh, plenty of time to take more calls. If you have a question or comment, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brooke in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Brooke.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question about the best way to address a group by saying you formally, or you plural. You all of you, what is your suggestion?
Yeah, the lack of a different word for the plural you has caused some regionalisms and some consternation, and there's no great answer for it.
Okay.
All of you, I guess, would be an easy way to get around it. But that does become an interesting study of regionalism. So in the South, you would have y'all or you all. In Pittsburgh, it's yins. In other parts of Pennsylvania, it's yous. In kind of the more vanilla regions where I've lived, it's you guys. And then people think you're being weird when you refer to women as you guys. So, yeah, that's a bit of a hole in the language. And so if you're public speaking, maybe you do say, I say to all of you, and
okay.
That's how you get around it.
All
thanks,
right,
Brooke.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brooke.
Thanks.
Yeah, I guess I say you guys.
Right. Yeah, I grew up in Michigan.
Yeah, me
I
too.
Think you did too. And that's the Michigan way of saying y'all.
Hey, you guys. Email from Morgan in Clintonville. When I hear someone use the word got, as in I got a car today, it drives me nuts. I feel there is always a better word to use in place of got. Is using got a grammar cop-out? Now, to that I will add, Bill Walsh, I have that problem of saying got, and I don't like it that I do it, but I do it, and I'm trying to get better.
It's a very common pet peeve, and I'm not entirely sure why. Maybe it's we were corrected when we were little for using it to just as a straight-up substitute for have.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you got any money?
Mm-hmm.
That would be wrong, but
right.
Have got is a perfectly good verb. Get is a perfectly good word. Once you get something, you got it.
Mm-hmm.
Not meaning you have got it. And so I think it gets a bit of a bad rap. It's a perfectly good word that maybe just sounds a little bit too crude and harsh. Maybe that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are plenty of cases where there's nothing wrong with it.
I guess I think about being more descriptive. So I got a gift for Christmas. I was given a gift. I was given a pair of headsets or, you know, given a computer.
Some people will just change got to receive.
Right.
And maybe it sounds a little bit more elegant, but there's certainly nothing wrong with it.
Okay, well. Email from Robert in Canton. He said, he asks, could Mr. Walsh please address the mushrooming use of the word folks, as opposed to using the word people or other descriptive terms, for example, voters or victims, in describing groups of individuals. In the book, The Age of American Unreason, Susan Jacoby calls the word folks a, quote, plague, end quote, spread by people ranging from the President of the United States to radio talk show hosts. Parenthetically, sorry, Anne, and it's true. I do use the word folks. So go ahead, Bill Walsh.
There does seem to have been a kind of, I don't know, maybe it's, you could liken it to the spread of the popularity of country music or pickup trucks or trucker hats or, you know, there does seem to be a growing informality in the country, and I think this is part of it. There, that's, you know, city folk bad, country folk good, and there I went using folk, and political speeches. You know, you went to Harvard and you're a lawyer and you're trying to get elected to public office, and maybe you don't want to address a group of farmers as my good fellows, and so you sort of adopt what you think they might speak like and say folks. And so that has kind of grown, that people have adopted that as a crutch, as kind of a whether it's fake or not, but a populism. And so, yeah, I can't say I'm entirely happy about it either, but that's maybe more a cultural discussion than a grammatical one.
It's an interesting one, and I think about the word folks because I've been criticized for it before, and I'm glad to take any of the criticism. But I think of, when did I first start hearing it? It was from The Music Man. Remember the guy in The Music Man who's folks, gather around.
Gather around, folks.
It was definitely that populist sort of a note to it.
And if you've ever studied logical fallacies, that's one of them is called plain folks, where if you want to try to argue that your point is correct, you say, well, I'm just a country boy from Oklahoma, and so what I say has to be right because I don't put on airs, you know, and that it's that sort of thing.
Right. Jim in Logan County, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. I have some questions about what I believe are object and subject pronouns. For example, the sentence, this is the title of a song, She Loves Jesus More Than She Loves Me.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was written, She Loves Jesus More Than I, it would have a completely different meaning. And you hear those confused quite a bit.
Hmm.
Right. I heard a good one of those the other night on TV. Yeah, she loves that more than me means she loves Jesus more than me. She loves Jesus more than she loves me. She loves Jesus more than I means she loves Jesus more than I do. And so you kind of have to watch yourself there. But there are some where you can get a little bit too pedantic. Are you taller than I? Are you taller than me? Either one of those, you can parse those sentences so that they work either way. So I don't get too worked up about those as long as there's no chance of ambiguity with Jesus or otherwise.
Thank you, Jim. An email from Megan is kind of related. She says, I have noticed an alarming trend in the past few years. People are using myself in non-reflexive contexts in droves, i.e., here is a picture of my brother and myself, when really it should be here is a picture of my brother and me. How can this trend be stopped and reversed? Okay.
I think what that reflects is an anxiety over whether me or I is correct. And so that's... Both of these are common pet peeves. People saying, him and me went to the store, or conversely, that's a good development for he and I. Both of those are wrong, but because it's another one where your mom or your school teacher would have corrected you in second grade, and then you get so anxious about it. And so myself becomes an easy way to get around it, but in fact, you're supposed to use myself only reflexively when you've already said me. So all of those, none of those are really on the top of my list of peeves, but I know when I get field questions like this, that comes up a lot.
Bill Walsh, thanks for joining us again. It's a lot of fun having you back.
It's been fun to be here.
Bill Walsh, he's a copy editor at the Washington Post and author of the new Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Now with more information on how you can support our station during our fall membership drive, here's membership director Rob Walker and All Sides producer Michael DeBonis.